In case you didn't know it, I am a firm believer in the value and investment of international travel. In fact, when I was working with the education program in Ohio, one of the first things that I wanted to institute, and we did institute, was a travel education program to what we call the Holy Lands. During the spring feast each year that I was there, we organized a trip, and we went to Egypt, we went to Greece, we went to Turkey, we went to Israel, we went to Jordan. And we traveled around these areas because I believe it gives a great advantage to those who can travel internationally. Not just to these areas, but any international travel gives you a perspective on the world that you would not have from home. If you can see something in your mind's eye, you have to use a lot of imagination. But if you can see something in reality, it really is motivating and life-changing in many cases. Linda and I came back from Turkey, and we have determined some new things in our life. And it really rejuvenated us and excited us. We saw Paul in a little different light. We had the chance to go to a little town called Miletus. And if you look in your Bible, in the book of Acts, you'll find Miletus is mentioned. Miletus was a port city to which Paul sailed. And from Miletus, he called for the elders of Ephesus to come and meet with him. And Acts 20 describes the little pep talk he gave the elders in the town of Miletus. It also says, and Luke writes about this, and I'm sure Luke would say of Paul, he's crazy, that guy. Because Paul was so motivated for his mission to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. It says that he landed in Troas, which was the Greek city for Troy. And it says that he walked. He insisted on walking. What's the word? He was determined, Paul writes. He was determined to walk from Troas to Miletus. Now, unless you've been there, you don't know what that entails. You can look on a map and you can even measure it out. It's over 100 miles. Now, you can sail from Troas to Miletus in about a day. To walk it takes about 2 weeks. And so you might say in your mind, who in their right mind would want to walk? Especially when you see the terrain. It was valleys, it's mountains, it's hills. It's not just a highway. There was probably roads and trails, but he was determined to walk it so he could have contact with people. That's just the way Paul was. And until you go and kind of see it personally, you don't understand that. That's the value. Now, I realize not everybody will travel internationally. That's why those that God has blessed with the opportunity will have the obligation to share that with all of you. And I plan to do that with Turkey in a little while. But I would like us to begin the sermon today in Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy 34, because God gave a man a vision of what was in his mind's eye. And it wasn't until the very end of his life that he actually got to see it with his own eyes. That man was Moses. Moses had the mission to take the people of God, the Israelites, from Egypt to the Promised Land. That was his mission. He fully intended to fulfill his mission. We're going to read here that he was 120 years old. And it says his vigor continued, never left his body at 120. He was excited about this opportunity to take the Israelites into the Promised Land. But we all know that he was a man. He had frailties and foibles. And because of his temper, sometimes got the best of him, God disallowed him to go into the Promised Land with the Israelites. But I'd like us to focus on Deuteronomy chapter 34, last chapter in Deuteronomy. It says, then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is a series of mountains, like we might say the Sierras, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan, all of Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah, as far as the western sea, all the way to the Mediterranean. He could see. I've had the blessing of being at that vista point. There's a monastery there now, but behind the monastery, they have a beautiful deck that they have built from which you can stand. They have these, you know, long binoculars. You can put a dime in and you can kind of look all over. You can take in the sight that Moses saw. From this vista, you're about 2,000 feet in elevation, and you can look across the river Jordan, which at that time was a real river that had sailing vessels on it. Now it's a trickle of a river, especially on the south end. I could actually long jump across it. Then it was a big river. You could look across the river and you could see the Promised Land. In fact, on the Jordanian side was part of the Promised Land. It was what was in, part of the settlement was on the, even the east side of the river. You could see all the way to the Mediterranean. You could see some of the big cities that were there that were promised to you as part of the Promised Land. Because God said, I'm going to take you in and I'm going to give you their houses. I'm going to give you their towns. I'm going to give you their granaries. I'm going to give you their vineyards. I'm going to give you their orchards. I'm going to give it to you. It's already there for the taking. You don't have to recreate it. It's what he promised them. So Moses got a chance to look at that. I'm sure he looked down at the bottom of the valley just beyond the Jordan River and saw this humongous walled city called Jericho. He probably wondered in his mind, how is God going to perform that miracle? How are we going to conquer that city? You could probably look off in the distance on the plateau of the mountain range that runs along, that makes up the spine of Israel, and he saw another big walled city, Arba, the city of the Anakim, the giants. Think about it. If you've got men who live there that are 10, 12 feet tall, you got 20-foot ceilings. Nice house, huh? Big gates, giant walls. He was able to look all the way to the north, it says, to the land of Dan. That's up near the Golan Heights and all the way into what today we know as Lebanon and Syria from this vista. And look all the way south to the Dead Sea and beyond to the desert south that they had crossed as they came across the Sinai Peninsula. He was able to look north and see the Sea of Galilee called Lake Tiberias. In fact, a lot of people go there today and they go, this is it? I thought this was a sea. And the Bible says Sea of Galilee, but it's just a lake. And you can stand on any shore and you can look across and see the next shore. It's not that big. But because of the mountains, the way they're formed, the weather fronts come in and can cause, you know, these kind of what they call mini storms on the surface of the water. And we read about a couple of those, you know, in the gospel accounts. But it's a little lake. But he could see that beautiful blue lake and how this river flowed down into the sea that was called Dead, because the living sea flowed into the Dead Sea. And there was nothing living in that sea. He could see all this land. And it says, then the Lord said to him in verse 4, this is the land of which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there. I'm sure there was a lot of heartache associated with the fact he knew he wasn't going to enter what he could see. A little disappointment. He knew that that generation that he had come out with was going to have to wander around for another 39 years in the wilderness. I'm sure he wondered about how God was going to perform his promise. He was a great leader. In fact, the Jews say he was the greatest of all prophets. Who was going to follow him? Who was going to be the leader? Well, we all know. Verse 9, now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid hands on him. So the children of Israel heeded him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. And we know some of the great and tremendous miracles that God performed at the hand of Joshua. But in my sermon today, I want to focus on another personality, another great leader that came from those who came out of Egypt with Moses. Let's go to Numbers 13. Numbers 13. I don't know how many of you have seen vistas like this. I can't help but think about it all the time. But when I lived in Southern California, I lived in Pasadena. I grew up in Pasadena, in Glendale, which is kind of in the middle of the San Gabriel Valley. For those of you who know the topography of Southern California, you have the San Gabriel Valley, then you have a strip of mountains, and then you have some lower mountains kind of to the west, and you have the San Fernando Valley, and then out to the east, you have what they call the Inland Empire, which is Riverside, San Bernardino, and that goes out to the desert. When I was a kid, I learned that there were trails to hike, and we hiked to the top of Mount Wilson. Maybe some of you are familiar with that. I know some of you who've been to Southern California would know where Mount Wilson is. It's 5,500 feet above sea level. And from Mount Wilson on a clear day, you can see all of the Los Angeles basin. You can see all the way to San Diego County. On a really clear day, you can see Catalina Island, which is 26 miles off of the coast. So whenever I stood on Mount Wilson after a long hike and looked out and saw this valley, I sometimes as a kid would pretend I was Moses looking at the promised land. And then I realized this is not the promised land, Los Angeles. Now, at that time, all of San Bernardino and Riverside was orange groves when I was a kid. That's changed a little bit. It's changed a whole lot, as a matter of fact. It's now industry and houses. But that's the kind of vista that God gave Moses. And I'm sure that as Moses saw that promised land in front of him, he had to wonder, how are the people going to make it? I brought them this far. How are they going to make it the rest of the way? Notice here in Numbers 13, and the Lord spoke to Moses, verse 2, and said, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, everyone a leader among them. So Moses chose 12 men, and these 12 men went in to this land. They spent 40 days marching up the Jordan Valley. They went all the way up to Dan. Then they crossed over the mountain range and they went down along the mountain range. And I'm sure at night they went around the bottom of these huge, big cities like Arba, where the Anak were. They went down and they looked at the stronghold of the Jebusites called Jebu, which later became Jerusalem. They looked at that. I'm sure they went across and they looked down at what is known as the wilderness of Judea. In fact, it says in verse 23, then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and there they cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they carried it between two men on a pole. Wow. I've been in a number of Bible classes growing up in the church, and we were to illustrate this in a drawing. You know, and I thought about this a lot. It was a cluster of grapes that was so heavy it took two men to carry it. It's pretty impressive. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. I'll let you in on a little secret. Linda's favorite beverage in Turkey is pomegranate juice. On nearly every corner in Turkey, they have a vendor on the side of the road who's got a big stand of pomegranates and oranges, fresh pomegranates. And they split open the pomegranates and they show you the meat of one of them. And the orange, you know, they open up and they have really good food in Turkey. And Linda would always say, oh, a pomegranate stand. Let's get a pomegranate juice. She loves pomegranate juice. What they do is they put the pomegranate in a juicer and they juice it right there in front of you. So you get a full cup, fresh pomegranate juice. So again, I can imagine these things in my mind's eye and I can see the great abundance that they brought from this land. And the place was called the Valley of Eshcol, verse 24, because of the cluster of grapes which the men cut there. And they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. They came back to Moses. In verse 27, they told him, they said, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is the fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. As a spy, how would you react? If you went to the city of Arba and you said, "Whoa, look at the size of those gates. Look at the size of this city." As you went by Jericho, "Wow, archaeologists tell us those walls were probably close to 45 to 50 feet tall. They were thick enough to drive two chariots across the top. The doors alone, 20 feet tall, double doors, gates as we might call them to these cities. They were very impressed. In fact, they were more than impressed. They were discouraged, as you might imagine. They said, "Who can conquer these people?" Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. Verse 28. Cities are fortified, very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, they dwell in the mountains. The Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. Caleb could see the way this discussion was going. It says Caleb quieted the people. And he said, "Let's go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." Let's go. I thought Justin was going to take my sermon. Let's continue on. But the men who had gone up with him said, "Well, we're not able to go up against a people like this. They're stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land. "The land through which we've gone as spies is a land that will devour its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature." Verse 1 now of chapter 14. "So the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept." Once again, their familiar refrain, "Why have you brought us all this way to kill us?" God, of course, at this point was fed up. Verse 22, "Because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and the wilderness and have put me to the test now 10 times, 10 times, he tested them, and they have not heeded my voice. They certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it." Moses, for 39 years, had to live with this reality that he was going to lead the people around the wilderness for 40 years. But I'd like you to notice verse 24. "But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it." It's an interesting verse. Thank you, Justin, for showing it on the screen. I want to talk about more than just the different spirit. I want to define what is different about Caleb. And what is it about Caleb's spirit that we can emulate? "My servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully." That's the key. What does that mean? Followed me fully. It comes from a very interesting Hebrew expression. It literally means to close the gap. You're probably wondering, what in the world does that mean? In the Hebrew, it literally means to close the gap. "He followed me fully." It basically means Caleb was close to God. He didn't allow the gap between him and God to get very big. Now, I don't know about you, but there are times when I feel close to God. And there are other times I don't feel quite as close to God. You ever experience that? Of course, we all experience that from time to time, don't we? What is it that draws us closer to God? What is it that draws us closer to God? Well, generally, we think of the spiritual disciplines, don't we? Prayer, Bible study, fasting, meditation, and fellowship. The five disciplines of spiritual development and growth. Verse 24 again, "But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully," he's closed the gap between him and him as a man and me as his God, "I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it." Maybe I can explain this Hebrew expression, closing the gap, a little better with an analogy that is in the commentary that I read that I can relate to. When I first moved to Canada, I was a relatively young man. I was 24, and all my friends in the church said, "Hey, Dave, you know what we do in Canada? We hunt. We hunt. We get meat. We fill the freezer." It was a manly thing to do. So, okay, I went hunting. I bought a rifle, and I went hunting. And over the next 10 years that I was in Canada, I hunted antelope. We hunted deer, of course, and moose and elk. And I got all of those except the elk. The elk, for some reason, I think the elk get a memo the day before hunting season, and they all go into the national parks in Canada where you can't shoot them. I'm pretty sure of that. I went elk hunting several years and never got one, but I was able to get a large moose. And this expression, closing the gap, is actually an expression that's used by hunters a lot in the ancient Hebrew definition. It was getting as close to you can as you can to the prey. That's what it meant. And, of course, they didn't have guns in those days. They had bows and arrows, right, or spears. And so they had to get as close as they could to their prey so that they could nail them and have food for their families. And I experienced this personally. I'll recount to you an adventure that I had in northern British Columbia, moose hunting. We went with a guide who was a member of the church there. And we went on horseback, and we were trailing moose. We'd find their trail in the snow, and we'd go along by horseback, and the moose is going here. And if you're following two moose, they'll sometimes go around a hill like that. They don't cluster in big herds like elk do. And as we were following this moose, the guide said, "These are very fresh tracks. I believe that this moose is on the other side of this hill in front of us, and he's probably over there digging around in the snow trying to get something to eat. And he's grazing on some grass or foliage beneath the snow." And he says, "What we need to do is get off our horses, and we need to sneak up this hill and get to the top of it and kind of close the gap between us and the moose." And so we did. We got off our horses. We tromped up this hill that's got about 2 feet deep of snow on it. So we're lifting our feet high, and we're trying to be as quiet as we can. And we finally get to the crest of the hill, and he says, "Now get down on your belly," which is not that much fun in 2 feet of snow, "and kind of crawl to the crest of the hill and look over." And we did, and we saw three moose down there in the bottom, three bull moose. I mean, these were big, probably 5.5-foot racks, big moose. We figured they were about 1,800 pounds each. And there were three of us hunters, and we all wanted to bag one of these. So he said, "We're still quite a ways away. We're still about 300-400 yards, and we want to get closer. We want to close the gap. So let's kind of crawl behind the ridge down here, because I think the moose are heading this way. And when they get a little closer to the end of the valley, we'll be closer to them to shoot them." So we crawled along the crest of the hill, and sure enough, the moose went down the valley. And when we got to the end, we were then a little less than 100 yards from them. And we got to the end, and we looked down, and we saw they were grazing. And the guide said, "Okay, guys, this is your chance. There's three of them down there. There's the three of you with three guns. Stand up and get them." And we did. I went hunting with Mr. McCullough, and I said, "Those moose had a Mac attack." Because we were able to kill all three moose. And we went down and we cleaned them. And we made sure they were properly covered up with pine boughs for the night, and we left them there to freeze because we had to come back the next day with pack animals and cut them in quarters and then pack them out. They were so big. Anyway, I learned the principle of closing the gap, you know, getting closer to the prey. So this expression describing the nature of Caleb was who wholly followed God. He closed the gap between himself and God. Now, I'd like you to go with me to Joshua chapter 14, because God made Caleb a promise. Caleb was viewed along with Joshua as a leader. In fact, they're mentioned in the same breath many times. And in fact, this expression, wholly followed God, describing Caleb, is used six times in the Old Testament. We get to Joshua chapter 14, beginning to read in verse 5. It says, as the Lord had commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did, and they divided the land. So they now have gone into the land. They've settled it. We're now into the land of promise. In verse 6, Joshua 14, 6, the children of Judah came to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, said, you know the word which the Lord said to Moses, to the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. He reminded Joshua what God had said from 39 years before. So you remember what God said? What he promised us? In verse 7, Caleb says, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought back word to him as it was in my heart. You know what I love about Caleb? He's brave. He's not afraid. He has a lot of faith in what God says, not unlike Moses and the faithful, Abraham, the father of the faithful. Verse 8, nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. That was on his mind for 40 years, and I'm sure he maintained that habit for 40 years. You know, there are people in the congregation that if you need encouraging, you know they're going to give you a pep talk. You know people like that? I do. I've got friends like that. You know, in the ministry, I know I can pick up the phone and say, you know, I'm kind of discouraged. And I know they're going to give me a pep talk because they're kind of Caleb-like. You know, I know they're close to God and they're going to say, come on, Dave, we can do it. You know, this is just a temporary setback. Let's go. Let's do this. Caleb would be that kind of man in a congregation. He'd say, sure, we can do it. We can overcome anything. We can. You bring it on, man. I'll take it on. You bring it on. I'll take it on. Verse 9, so Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land where your foot has trodden shall be your inheritance and your children's forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God. And now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive. See, all of his friends died in the wilderness, as God prophesied. And he said, these 45 years, ever since the Lord spoke this word to Moses, while Israel wandered in the wilderness now, here I am this day, 85 years old. As yet, I am as strong as the day that Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so now is my strength for war, both for going in and for going out. He didn't say, okay, this will probably be my last battle. I can go out, but I probably can't get back in. No, he's 85 years old, and he says, bring them on. I'm ready. I like this attitude, don't you? As yet I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. Now therefore, verse 12, give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke in that day. For you heard in that day how the Anakim were there, and that the cities were great and fortified. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. Look at this guy's attitude. He says, give me the meanest, tallest, dirtiest fighting, bad guys, and I want to take them on. He says, I want the 12-footers. Bring on the Anakim. He says, I want you, Joshua, to tell me that I can have the city of Arba and that mountain. So Joshua blessed him in verse 13 and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as an inheritance. Hebron, therefore, became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. And the name of Hebron formerly was Kirjah Arba, because Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Then the land had rest from war. Caleb changed the name of the city from Arba. I'm sure he said, that horrible, giant, uncircumcised Anakim, I'm not going to live in a city named after him. I'm going to change the name of the city. So he changed it to Hebron. Hebron is there today. Today it is a Palestinian stronghold. You've probably seen it in the news. Sometimes from Hebron, the Palestinians protest against the Israelis. It's up along that mountain ridge. It's north. If you look at your map, it's north of Jerusalem by about 40 miles, 50 miles. But at this time, it was the second strongest city in the land of Canaan. The first was Jericho. We know what happened to Jericho. God knocked it down. That became the wilderness of Judah, and Judah took over that area. Caleb was promised Arba, that he renamed Hebron. Why did he rename it Hebron? You know what Hebron means? Hebron means fellowship. Because Caleb, in his mind, saw that he was in fellowship with God. And he realized that God saw him as in fellowship with himself, with God. That's how God viewed him. Because, as it says here at least three times in this chapter, chapter 14, that he wholly followed God. He wholeheartedly, with all of his heart, all of his soul, there was no doubt. He had complete confidence and faith in God. And he and God were like that. You know, Abraham is called the father of the faithful, and he's called the friend of God. Caleb didn't want to usurp that title, but he was willing to say, I'm going to rename this big city that I'm going to take. And he took it. And he drove the Anakim out. And he and his descendants went in to possess it. He renamed it Hebron, which means fellowship, fellowshipping with God. One key element to fully following the Lord is fellowship. And that's what I want to talk about today. This valuable tool that we can use to build our faith and to follow the example of Caleb in fully following the Lord. I'd like to turn to 1 John chapter 1. Now to the New Testament. 1 John chapter 1. Caleb, of course, had fellowship with Joshua at the time and Moses. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Their spiritual iron to sharpen their spiritual iron. Fellowship today is important in the Church of God because it can help build our faith. It's kind of interesting. I was attending a conference in February back in Allen, Texas, of the ministerial services team, and we were talking about issues and problems that we needed to tackle in the church. And one of the issues that was brought up was this issue of church attendance and fellowship. It has affected the Church of God. I've got friends like it affects every fellowship. It seems to be a symptom of the times in which we live. Sometimes people are just not very consistent. People have difficulty committing organizationally or even to a fellowship group. People come and go. can be discouraging to other people. And a lot of people say, well, I'm in fellowship with God. You know, I tune into a webcast or I tune into a taped sermon every Sabbath. And I'm, you know, it's me and God. I'm fellowshipping with God. Well, the Bible says something different. Let's read 1 John chapter 1, verse 3. Fellowship is the opposite of the independent spirit. It says in verse 3, that which we have seen and heard, we declare to you, that you may also have fellowship with us. He says, the way that we really get to know each other is to talk and to tell each other about our lives, our experiences, our hopes, our desires, sometimes our disappointments, our troubled times, our trials, our discouragements. That's how we get to know each other. That you also may have fellowship with us, and truly our fellowship is with the Father and His Son, Jesus Christ. When we fellowship one with another, John is saying, it's like fellowshipping with God. It's Caleb-like, if I can use that. It contributes towards holy following or fully following the Lord. I'll give you an example. When our family, back in 1955, first moved to Southern California, my father had been accepted to Ambassador College, and so he dragged all of us out there. We lived in a trailer park. My dad sold his business, and he bought a 30-foot trailer, and we were crammed in the two bedrooms of that little trailer, my brother and my parents and I, and we went to church that first Sabbath, not knowing what to expect. And we entered into what became the library building. Maybe some of you have been down there and seen that library building. It was an old house that had been redone on the campus. And we entered in there, and there was such a big church. Such a big church. There were 50 people in there. And they all met in the big, what used to be the living room of that building. And there weren't quite enough chairs for the kids, so those of us who were little, all of us kids, I remember we sat on the stairs in that building. It had wide stairs that went upstairs, and that was where the recording studio was for the radio program. And there were 50 people there. When we attended church in St. Louis, there were 8 of us. So to go from 8 to 50, this was a big church. Wow. We were impressed. 50 people, and there were other kids there. I'd been going to church as a kid between the ages of 5 and 8, and there were no other kids. Some of us still know that, right? There's no kids our age. We complain a little bit. But I got there, and there were other kids my age. And they were sitting on the stairs, too. And I figured out where I could sit on the stairs, and my parents could look around from their seats, and they couldn't see me. I mean, you figure out all the tricks early on, right, when you're a kid. So we sat there on the stairs Sabbath after Sabbath. But I still remember the first Sabbath we were there, there was a family that came up to us and said, hey, you're new here, aren't you? Not hard to figure out, a congregation of 50, right? I mean, if Justin's friend comes here, we'll know he's new, right? We're small enough, we can spot him. So they said, you're new here. We said, yes. They said, hey, you want to come over after church and have dinner with us? We don't have a whole lot, but you know, we got cornbread and we got some warm beans. You know, we can do something special like cut up a couple of hot dogs and throw those in the beans. And we said, yeah, be great. I still remember this family. Never forgot them. We went to their home and we fellowshiped that evening. They had a son my age. And I grew up with that guy in the church in Pasadena. And I still remember that family. They were very hospitable. They reached out to us. And as a result of that very positive experience, our first Sabbath at church, our family did the same thing. When we went to church from then on out, we'd look for the new faces and go to them and introduce ourselves and ask them over for dinner. Because isn't that where you learn about each other and where we understand from which we fellowship and why we fellowship? And that seemed to strengthen my parents' faith, that attitude of service. I can remember very few Saturday nights that we went home without bringing somebody with us. for dinner. Now, I realize not everybody has that opportunity, and many of us are scattered. You know, there are always reasons why. We know that from the 10 spies, don't we? Let's go to Hebrews 10. Hebrews, the 10th chapter. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 24. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. You know, you can't follow that admonition. None of us can unless we get to know each other. Unless we talk, unless we visit, unless we mix, unless we spend time together. I don't know if you noticed it, but in the weekly update that I sent out and I announced that we're having potlucks this week, and I said they're love feasts. I don't know if you noticed that, but I did it on purpose. Because those are love feasts. Those are times we get together and we can sit around the table and we can talk and get to know each other. That's the way we consider one another, and we evaluate what we talk about, and we try to stir each other up with love and good works. My parents were, as I mentioned, stirred, and my parents were ordained a deacon and deaconess in the church. And they set a very good example for me of service. They served. Like I said, we literally had people over all the time, even though sometimes we couldn't afford much more than that cornbread and bean bowl. There was one particular family that I remember my parents invited over. They had a daughter about the same age as my little sister. I was a senior in high school, and I was about to go to college. So I didn't get to know this family really well, but I heard about them all the time because my parents and this family got really close. And they inspired this family, so eventually they were ordained deacon and deaconess in the church. And they served in a similar way. And my parents moved out of Southern California about 1979, moved back to Missouri, and this other family moved to Vancouver, Washington. So they kind of lost contact. You know, they would say hello at the feast once in a while, or they would exchange, you know, a letter occasionally, but they kind of lost contact for, it would now be the better part of, what, 20, 35 years? 40 years? I'm being corrected by Linda, 40 years. They kind of lost contact. My mother called me a couple of years ago, and I'm getting ahead of myself. Back in 2008, my father died. He had a stroke, a couple of mini strokes, and then he finally died. And my mother became a widow, naturally. And I promised my dad before he died that I'd take care of Mom, make sure she was well taken care of. And so I went back to Missouri a couple times for trips and made sure she had good housing, which she did. Dad had bought her a nice trailer to live in, a nice trailer park, paid for that before he died. And I made sure she was getting her Social Security and other benefits that she was entitled to. And, you know, I wanted to make sure she was financially secure. She wasn't rich by any means, but she was going to be okay. And I told her, you got to watch your P's and Q's. Don't overspend, you know. And my sister lived in the same town, so I thought my sister and my brother-in-law could look after her as well. And that went along until 2 years ago, and then she called me. And she says, Dave, are you sitting down? And I said, well, what's going on, Mom? Now, you have to understand, my mother called me about 3 times a week. And she kept telling me all this time, from 2008 until about 2 years ago, I'm lonely. And I said, I know, Mom, you know, you're a widow and you and Dad were married for over 60 years. I understand this. And she says, no, you don't understand. I'm just lonely. And I could tell she didn't seem very happy. She's just lonely. And I said, well, you got your sister and you got your daughter close by. And I visit once in a while and you can call me anytime. I know, I'm just lonely. So when she called me, she says, are you sitting down? I didn't know what to expect from my mother. I said, what is it, Mom? She said, I'm getting married. Now, at the time, my mother was 82. I'm going, you're 82, Mom. As if she didn't know that. She said, I know that. And I said, do you mind me asking who you're getting married to? And she told me. And I said, oh, you've known that family for 40 years. And she said, yes. And his wife died of cancer about a year ago. And I wrote him a letter of sympathy. And he wrote me back. And he wrote me, and I wrote him another letter. And he wrote me, and I wrote another letter. And he wrote me, and we got the phone call. And, you know, one thing leads to another. And the next thing you know, he asked me to marry him. And I said, yes. Mom, it's kind of sudden. She says, Dave, I'm 82. Don't have a lot of time. I said, that's great, Mom. Because I knew this family. He was now a widower. She was a widow. They got married a little over a year ago. They thought it was going to be great because we lived in Portland and they're living in Vancouver, Washington, right across the river, and we're going to be real close. And then we got transferred down here. And of course, now I hear from my mother about once every 6 weeks, which is a good sign. That means she's happy and busy. And I ask people up there, how's Mom doing? And they say, oh, yeah, we saw her and Daryl. They were in the store holding hands, skipping down the aisle of the grocery store. Oh, now they're 84 and having fun. But it was because of the bonds they built with another family 40 years ago in the church. I had to think, have things changed that much? Well, our culture's changed, hasn't it? How is it that we can follow the example of Caleb and enter into this relationship with God, kind of close the gap? One of the vehicles that we can use is fellowship. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. Verse 25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some. Aha! It's not just a 21st century problem. It's been a problem since the first century. People get distracted. Maybe they get discouraged. Maybe they just don't believe they have the courage to fight the giants in life anymore. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another. That's encouraging one another. And so much the more as we see the day approaching. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 11. Therefore, comfort each other. As we all know, there's a time to comfort. As Ecclesiastes says, a time to mourn with those who mourn. There's a time to comfort each other and edify one another. That's build each other up. Just as you also are doing. He complimented the Thessalonica church. He says, look, you have a good base for fellowship. And that fellowship can narrow the gap between you and God if we understand the example of Caleb correctly. I think we do. Look at verse 14. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly. You know, sometimes peer correction is better than the minister telling people they're off base. If your friends tell you, hey, that's weird thinking. Why are you thinking that? That's not correct. Peer feedback is one of the best ways for us to remain loyal and close to God. We exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly. He doesn't say, hey, I exhort you, fellow elders. He says, I exhort you, brethren. Warn those who are unruly. The truth in love. Right? Comfort the faint-hearted. Uphold the weak. Be patient with all. How in the world do we do that unless we get to know each other really well? And that takes fellowship. That takes talking together, and more than just every Sabbath. I mean, every Sabbath would be a good start. And of course, if I talk about the importance of fellowship, sometimes those who need to hear that don't regularly attend. Isn't that the way it is? I'd like to share with you a couple of comments from a book I'm reading right now called The Road to Character by David Brooks. I don't know how many of you know David Brooks or have seen him or read his op-ed articles. He writes for the New York Times, but he also is a regular commentator on public broadcasting. If you ever watch PBS News, you'll probably encounter David Brooks from one time or another. But this book kind of struck me because anything that has character in the title or virtues or humility, I wanted to read it. I kind of been on this quest since I worked in Cincinnati for a while because character was one of the things that we wanted to focus on in our education programs, building character. And there are very few books really written on this. And I'd like to just share with you, I haven't completely read the book yet, but I'd like to share with you some of the quotes that he talks about in reference to our culture today and how challenging it is to kind of get to know each other very well. He said, "Recently I've been thinking about the difference between the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. The resume virtues are the ones you list on your resume, the skills that you bring to the job market, and that contribute to external success. The eulogy virtues are deeper. They're the virtues that get talked about at your funeral, the ones that exist at the core of your being, whether you are kind, brave, honest, or faithful, what kind of relationships you formed in a lifetime." Then he also talks a little bit about our culture today. He says, "The culture in which we live today is called the culture of the big me. The big me." For example, in 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school seniors if they considered themselves to be very important people. At that point, 12% said yes. The same question was asked in 2005, and this time it wasn't 12% who considered themselves very important, it was 80%. Psychologists have a thing called the narcissism test. They read people statements and ask if the statements apply to them, and statements such as, "I like to be the center of attention. I show off if I get the chance because I'm extraordinary. Somebody should write a biography about me." The median narcissism score has risen 30% in the last two decades. 93% of young people score higher than the middle score just 20 years ago. The biggest gains have been in the number of people who agree with the statements, "I am an extraordinary person and I like to look at my body." Now, for those of us who are older, we know better than that. We pass mirrors very quickly. He writes on, "Along with this apparent rise in self-esteem, there has been a tremendous increase in the desire for fame. Fame used to rank low as a life's ambition for most people. In 1976, surveys that asked people to list their life goals, fame ranked 15th out of 16. By 2007, 51% of people reported that being famous was one of their top personal goals. In one study, middle school girls were asked who they would most like to have over for dinner or to have dinner with. Number one answer, Jennifer Lopez. Way down the list, Jesus Christ. Paris Hilton came in third. The girls were then asked which of the following jobs they would like to have, and nearly twice as many said they'd rather be a celebrity's personal assistant, for example, Justin Bieber's, than president of Harvard University. Tells us a little bit about how young people think today. And finally, this quote, "This self-centeredness leads in several unfortunate directions. It leads to selfishness, the desire to use other people as a means to get things for yourself. It also leads to pride, the desire to see yourself as superior to everybody else. It leads to a capacity to ignorance and rationalize your own imperfections and inflate your own virtues. As we go through life, most of us are constantly comparing, and constantly finding ourselves slightly better than other people. Why do we fellowship? Is it all about me? I've heard people say that. You know, I come to church and I just don't get anything out of it anymore. I've heard people say that. You don't get anything out of fellowship? No, it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't, it's not for me. Why do we come to church? To fellowship? I hope so. Sometimes people say, well, like, I want to stay home and just watch it on the screen. You know, I'll watch the sermon. I can watch, you know, your sermons from Reading on the screen. And I go, what are you doing for the church? You just told me what the church does for you, but what do you do for the church? Let's read verse 14 again, 2 Thessalonians chapter 4. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all. It doesn't say come to church so they can pick you up. We should come to church sometime, even if we're a little down, and say, you know, today I'm going to be Caleb, and I'm going to try to cheer somebody up. I'm going to find somebody who's discouraged, and I'm going to try to encourage them. I'm going to find somebody who needs to hear my lousy joke, just to cheer them up. To comfort the faint-hearted, to uphold the weak, to be patient with all. Let's go over to 1 John. I'd like to end up over here in 1 John. 1 John chapter 1, verse 7. But if we walk in the light as He is in the light, we all want to emulate Christ. We're Christians, right? But it seems like our culture, we have absorbed a lot of this, the big me. We want to know what's in it for me. Whereas we should say, what can I do for the church? Can I help you take on the big giants? Can I do something to close the gap between me and God? Like Caleb did. It says in verse 7, if we walk in the light as He is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. What he's saying is, you really want to be a Christian? Then don't neglect this important tool of spiritual growth and faith. I think all of us would agree that Caleb was filled with faith. And the reason he felt he was filled with faith is because he felt close to God. He said, I'm in fellowship with God. He renamed his town Fellowship. I think that's so cool. What if you had the chance to rename the city of Los Angeles? What would you name it? City of the Angels? I hope not. Would it reflect your character trait? If we walk in the light as He is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, His Son, cleanses us from all sin. Fellowship seems to have a lot to do with salvation itself. 1 John chapter 4, verse 11. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. And brethren, I contend we cannot do that unless we get to know each other, unless we fellowship. No one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us, and His love has been perfected in us. By this we know that we abide in Him, and He in us, because He has given us His Spirit. And I believe that His Spirit, a different spirit than the other 10, was in Caleb. think Caleb's example screams out loud to us. In order for us to have that kind of faith to fight the giants in life, I think we need to practice the spiritual disciplines that will bring that fruit that we all want and that joy that we can have. Let's go to chapter 1 and verse 3 again. I'd like to reread this and I'd like to add in verse 4. John, 1 John 1, 3. That which we have seen and heard, we declare to you, that you also may have fellowship with us. And truly our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. When we fellowship with one another, we fellowship with God and His Son. And these things we write to you, that your joy may be full. We all want joy in our lives. We all want the fruit of God's Spirit in our lives. And the fruit of that Spirit that can give us faith is when we narrow the gap between us and God. And we wholly, 100%, follow God because we're close to God. And one of the most important tools to gain that closeness to God is fellowship within the body of Christ.